Chapter 16. Beginning of War. For reason, or reasons unknown, to members of the galaxy at the time of the era under discussion, Intergalactic Standard Time defines its fundamental unit, the second, as the time in which light travels 299,776 kilometers. 86,400 seconds are arbitrarily set equal to one intergalactic standard day, and 365 of these days to one intergalactic standard year. Why 299,776, or 86,400, or 365? Tradition, says the historian, begging the question. Because of certain and various mysterious numerical relationships, say the mystics, cultists, numerologists, metaphysicists. Because the original home planet of humanity had certain natural periods of rotation and revolution, from which those relationships could be derived, say a very few. No one really knew. Nevertheless, the date on which the Foundation cruiser, the Hober Mallow, met the Kalganian squadron, headed by the Fearless, and upon refusing to allow a search party to board, was blasted into smoldering wreckage, was 185-11692 GE. That is, it was the 185th day of the 11,692nd year of the Galactic Era, which dated from the accession of the first emperor of the traditional Campbell dynasty. It was also 185-419 AS, dating from the birth of Selden, or 185-348 YF, dating from the establishment of the Foundation. On Kalgan, it was 185-56 FC, dating from the establishment of the first citizenship by the Mule. In each case, of course, for convenience, the year was so arranged as to yield the same day number regardless of the actual day upon which the era began. And in addition to all the millions of worlds of the galaxy, there were millions of local times, based on the motions of their own particular heavenly neighbors. But whichever you choose, 185, 11692, 419, 348, 56, or anything, it was this day which historians later pointed to when they spoke of the start of the Stettinian War. Yet to Dr. Darrell, it was none of these at all. It was simply and quite precisely the 32nd day since Arcadia had left Terminus. What it cost Darrell to maintain stolidity through these days was not obvious to everyone. But Elvet Semmick thought he could guess. He was an old man, and fond of saying that his neuronic sheaths had calcified to the point where his thinking processes were stiff and unwieldy. He invited, and almost welcomed, the universal underestimation of his decaying powers by being the first to laugh at them. But his eyes were nonetheless seeing for being faded, his mind nonetheless experienced and wise for being no longer agile. He merely twisted his pinched lips and said, "Why don't you do something about it?" The sound was a physical jar to Darrell, under which he winced. He said gruffly, "Where were we?" Semmick regarded him with grave eyes. "You'd better do something about the girl." His sparse yellow teeth showed in a mouth that was open in inquiry. But Darrell replied coldly, "The question is, can you get a Sims-Molf resonator in the range required?" "Well, I said I could, and you weren't listening." "I'm sorry, Elvet. It's like this. What we're doing now can be more important to everyone in the galaxy than the question of whether Arcadia is safe. At least to everyone but Arcadia and myself. And I'm willing to go along with the majority. How big would the resonator be?" Semmick looked doubtful. "I don't know. You can find it somewheres in the catalogs." "About how big? A ton? A pound? A block long?" "Oh, I thought you meant exactly. It's a little jigger." He indicated the first joint of his thumb. "About that." "All right. Can you do something like this?" He sketched rapidly on the pad he held in his lap, then passed it over to the old physicist, who peered at it doubtfully, then chuckled. "You know, the brain gets calcified when you get as old as I am. What are you trying to do?" Darrell hesitated. He longed desperately, at the moment, for the physical knowledge locked in the other's brain, so that he need not put his thought into words. But the longing was useless, and he explained. Semmick was shaking his head. "You'd need hyper-relays, the only things that would work fast enough. Thundering lot of them. But it can be built?"
"Well, sure."
"Can you get all the parts? I mean, without causing comment. in line with your general work? Semik lifted his upper lip. Can't get 50 hyper-relays. I wouldn't use that many in my whole life. We are on a defense project now. Can you think of something harmless that would use them? We've got the money. Maybe I can think of something. How small can you make the whole gadget? Hyper-relays can be had micro-size. Wiring, tubes. Space, you got a few hundred circuits there. I know. How big? Semik indicated with his hands. Too big, said Darrow. I've got to swing it from my belt. Slowly, he was crumpling his sketch into a tight ball. When it was a hard yellow grape, he dropped it into the ashtray and it was gone, with the tiny white flare of molecular decomposition. He said, Who's at your door? Semik leaned over his desk to the little milky screen above the door signal. He said, The young fellow, Anthor. Someone with him, too. Darrell scraped his chair back. Nothing about this, Semik, to the others yet. It's deadly knowledge, if they find out. And two lives are enough to risk. Peleus Anthor was a pulsing vortex of activity in Semik's office, which somehow managed to partake of the age of its occupant. In the slow turgor of the quiet room, the loose, summery sleeves of Anthor's tunic seemed still a-quiver with the outer breezes. He said, Dr. Darrell, Dr. Semik, Aurum Dirridge. The other man was tall, a long, straight nose that lent his thin face a saturnine appearance. Dr. Darrell held out a hand. Anthor smiled slightly. Police Lieutenant Dirridge, he amplified. Then significantly, of Calgan. And Darrell turned to stare with force at the young man. Police Lieutenant Dirridge of Calgan, he repeated distinctly. And you bring him here. Why? Because he was the last man on Calgan to see your daughter. Hold, man! Anthor's look of triumph was suddenly one of concern, and he was between the two, struggling violently with Darrell. Slowly, and not gently, he forced the older man back into the chair. What are you trying to do? Anthor brushed a lock of brown hair from his forehead, tossed a hip lightly upon the desk, and swung a leg thoughtfully. I thought I was bringing you good news. Darrell addressed the policeman directly. What does he mean by calling you the last man to see my daughter? Is my daughter dead? Please tell me without preliminary. His face was white with apprehension. Lieutenant DeRidge said expressionlessly, Last man on Calgan was the phrase. She's not on Calgan now. I have no knowledge past that. Here, broke in Anthor. Let me put it straight. Sorry if I overplay the drama a bit, Doc. You're so inhuman about this, I forget you have feelings. In the first place, Lieutenant Dirridge is one of us. He was born on Calgan, but his father was a Foundation man brought to that planet in the service of the Mule. I answer for the Lieutenant's loyalty to the Foundation. Now, I was in touch with him the day after we stopped getting the daily report from Mun. Why? Broke in Darrell fiercely. I thought it was quite decided that we were not to make a move in the matter. You were risking their lives and ours. Because, was the equally fierce retort. I've been involved in this game for longer than you, because I know of certain contacts on Calgan of which you know nothing, because I act from deeper knowledge. Do you understand? I think you're completely mad. Will you listen? A pause, and Darrell's eyes dropped. Anthor's lips quirked into a half smile. All right, Doc. Give me a few minutes. Tell him, Dirridge. Dirridge spoke easily. As far as I know, Dr. Darrell, your daughter is at Trantor. At least she had a ticket to Trantor at the Eastern Spaceport. She was with a trading representative from that planet who claimed she was his niece. Your daughter seems to have a queer collection of relatives, Doctor. That was the second uncle she had in a period of 2 weeks, huh? The Trantorian even tried to bribe me. Probably thinks that's why they got away. He smiled grimly at the thought. Ah, was she? Unharmed, as far as I could see. Frightened. I don't blame her for that. The whole department was after her. I still don't know why. Darrell drew a breath for what seemed the first time in several minutes. He was conscious of the trembling of his hands and controlled them with an effort. Then she's all right, this trading representative. Who was he? Go back to him. What part does he play in it? I don't know. Do you know anything about Trantor? I lived there once. It's an agricultural world now. Exports animal fodder and grains mostly. High quality. They sell them all over the galaxy. There are a dozen or two farm cooperatives on the planet, and each has its representatives overseas. Shrewd sons of guns, too. I knew this one's record. He'd been on Calgan before, usually with his wife. Perfectly honest, perfectly harmless. Said Anthor. Arcadia was born on Trantor, wasn't she, Doc? Daryl nodded. It hangs together, you see. She wanted to go away, quickly and far, and Trantor would suggest itself. Don't you think so? Daryl said. Why not back here? Perhaps she was being pursued, and felt that she had to double off in a new angle, huh? Dr. Daryl lacked the heart to question further. Well, then, let her be safe on Trantor, or as safe as one could be anywhere in this dark and horrible galaxy. He groped toward the door, felt Anthor's light touch on his sleeve, and stopped, but did not turn. Mind if I go home with you, Doc? You're welcome, was the automatic response. By evening, the exterior-most reaches of Dr. Daryl's personality, the ones that made immediate contact with other people, had solidified once more. He had refused to eat his evening meal, and had instead, with feverish insistence, returned to the inchward advance into the intricate mathematics of encephalographic analysis. It was not till nearly midnight that he entered the living room again. Peleus Anthor was still there, twiddling at the controls of the video. The footsteps behind him caused him to glance over his shoulder. Hi, aren't you in bed yet? I've been spending hours on the video, trying to get something other than bulletins. Seems the F.S. Hober Mallow is delayed in course and hasn't been heard from. Really? What do they suspect? What do you think? Calganian skullduggery. There are reports that Calganian vessels were sighted in the general space sector in which the Hober Mallow was last heard from. Daryl shrugged, and Anthor rubbed his forehead doubtfully. Look, Doc, he said. Why don't you go to Trantor? Why should I? Because you're no good to us here. You're not yourself. You can't be. And you could accomplish your purpose by going to Trantor, too. The old Imperial Library, with the complete records of the proceedings of the Selden Commissioner there... No! The library has been picked clean, and it hasn't helped anyone. It helped Ebling Miz once. How do you know? Yes, he said he found the Second Foundation, and my mother killed him 5 seconds later as the only way to keep him from unwittingly revealing its location to the mule. But in doing so, she also, you realize, made it impossible ever to tell whether Miz really did know the location. After all, no one else has ever been able to deduce the truth from those records. Ebling Miz, if you'll remember, was working under the driving impetus of the mule's mind. I know that, too, but Miz's mind was, by that very token, in an abnormal state. Do you and I know anything about the properties of a mind under the emotional control of another? About its abilities and shortcomings? In any case, I will not go to Trantor. Anthor frowned. Well, why the vehemence? I merely suggested it as... Well, by space, I don't understand you. You look 10 years older. You're obviously having a hellish time of it. You're not doing anything of value here. If I were you, I'd go and get the girl. Exactly. It's what I want to do, too. That's why I won't do it. Look, Anthor, try to understand. You're playing, we're both playing, with something completely beyond our powers to fight. In cold blood, if you have any, you know that. Whatever you may think in your moments of quixoticism. For 50 years we've known that the Second Foundation is the real descendant and pupil of Seldonian mathematics. What that means, and you know that too, is that nothing in the galaxy happens which does not play a part in their reckoning. To us, all life is a series of accidents, to be met with by improvisations. To them, all life is purposive, and should be met by precalculation. But they have their weakness. Their work is statistical, and only the mass action of humanity is truly inevitable. Now, how I play a part, as an individual, in the foreseen course of history, I don't know. Perhaps I have no definite part, since the plan leaves individuals to indeterminacy and free will. But I am important, and they, you understand, may at least have calculated my probable reaction. So I distrust my impulses, my desires, my probable reactions. I would rather present them with an improbable reaction. I will stay here, despite the fact that I yearn very desperately to leave. No, because I yearn very desperately to leave. The young man smiled sourly. You don't know your own mind as well as they might. Suppose that, knowing you, they might count on what you think, merely think, is the improbable reaction simply by knowing in advance what your line of reasoning would be. In that case, there is no escape. For if I follow the reasoning you have just outlined and go to Trantor, they may have foreseen that too. There is an endless cycle of double crosses. No matter how far I follow that cycle, I can only either go or stay. The intricate act of luring my daughter halfway across the galaxy cannot be meant to make me stay where I am, since I would most certainly have stayed if they had done nothing. It can only be to make me move, and so I will stay. Besides, Anthor, not everything bears the breath of the Second Foundation. Not all events are the results of their puppeteering. They may have had nothing to do with Arcadia's leave-taking, and she may be safe on Trantor when all the rest of us are dead. No, said Anthor sharply. Now you are off the track. You have an alternative interpretation? I have, if you'll listen. Oh, go ahead. I don't lack patience. Well then, how well do you know your own daughter? How well can any individual know any other? Obviously, my knowledge is inadequate. So is mine on that basis, perhaps even more so. But at least I viewed her with fresh eyes. Item one, she is a ferocious little romantic, the only child of an ivory tower academician, growing up in an unreal world of video and book film adventure. She lives in a weird, self-constructed fantasy of espionage and intrigue. Item two, she's intelligent about it, intelligent enough to outwit us at any rate. She planned carefully to overhear our first conference and succeeded. She planned carefully to go to Calgan with Mun, and succeeded. Item three. She has an unholy hero worship of her grandmother, your mother, who defeated the mule. I'm right so far, I think? All right, then. Now, unlike you, I've received a complete report from Lieutenant DeRidge. And in addition, my sources of information on Calgan are rather complete, and all sources check. We know, for instance, that Homier Mun, in conference with the Lord of Calgan, was refused admission to the Mule's palace, and that this refusal was suddenly abrogated after Arcadia had spoken to Lady Calia, the First Citizen's very good friend. Daryl interrupted. And how do you know all this? For one thing, Mun was interviewed by DeRidge as a part of the police campaign to locate Arcadia. Naturally, we have a complete transcript of the questions and answers. And take Lady Calia herself. It is rumored that she has lost Stetton's interest, but the rumor isn't borne out by facts. She not only remains unreplaced, is not only able to mediate the Lord's refusal to Mun into an acceptance, but can even engineer Arcadia's escape openly. Why, a dozen of the soldiers about Stetton's executive mansion testified that they were seen together on the last evening, yet she remains unpunished. This, despite the fact that Arcadia was searched for with every appearance of diligence. But what is your conclusion from all this torrent of ill connection? That Arcadia's escape was arranged. As I said, with this addition, that Arcadia must have known it was arranged. That Arcadia, the bright little girl who saw cabals everywhere, saw this one and followed your own type of reasoning. They wanted her to return to the Foundation, and so she went to Trantor instead. But why Trantor? Well, why? Because that is where Beta, her idolized grandmother, escaped when she was in flight. Consciously or unconsciously, Arcadia imitated that. I wonder, then, if Arcadia was fleeing the same enemy. The mule? Asked Daryl with polite sarcasm. Of course not. I mean by the enemy, a mentality that she could not fight. She was running from the Second Foundation, or such influence thereof as could be found on Calgan. What influence is this you speak of? Do you expect Calgan to be immune from that ubiquitous menace? We have both come to the conclusion somehow that Arcadia's escape was arranged, right? She was searched for and found, but deliberately allowed to slip away by DeRidge. By DeRidge, do you understand? But how was that? Because he was our man, but how did they know that? Were they counting on him to be a traitor, huh, Doc? Now you're saying that they honestly meant to recapture her. Frankly, you're tiring me a bit, Anthor. Finish your say. I want to go to bed. My say is quickly finished. Anthor reached for a small group of photo records in his inner pocket. It was the familiar wigglings of the encephalograph. DeRidge's brainwaves, Anthor said casually. Taken since he returned. It was quite visible to Daryl's naked eye, and his face was gray when he looked up. He is controlled. Exactly. He allowed Arcadia to escape, not because he was our man, but because he was the second Foundation's. Even after he knew she was going to Trentor, and not to Terminus. Anthor shrugged. He had been geared to let her go. There was just no way he could modify that. He was only a tool, you see. It was just that Arcadia followed the least probable course, and is probably safe. Or at least safe until such time as the Second Foundation can modify the plans to take into account this changed state of affairs. He paused. The little signal light on the video set was flashing. On an independent circuit, it signified the presence of emergency news. Daryl saw it too, and with the mechanical movement of long habit, turned on the video. They broke in upon the middle of a sentence, but before its completion, they knew that the Hober Mallow, or the wreck thereof, had been found, and that for the first time in nearly half a century, the Foundation was again at war. Anthor's jaw was set in a hard line. All right, Doc, you heard that. Calgan is attacked, and Calgan is under the control of the Second Foundation. Will you follow your daughter's lead and move to Trantor? No, I will risk it. Here. Dr. Darrow, you are not as intelligent as your daughter. I wonder how far you can be trusted. His long, level stare held Darrow for a moment, and then without a word, he left. And Darrow was left in uncertainty and almost despair. Unheeded, the video was a medley of excited sight sound, as it described in nervous detail the first hour of the war between Calgan and the Foundation. Chapter 17. War. The mayor of the Foundation brushed futilely at the picket fence of hair that rimmed his skull. He sighed. The years that we have wasted, the chances we have thrown away. I make no recriminations, Dr. Darrell, but we deserve defeat. Darrell said quietly, I see no reason for lack of confidence in events, sir. Lack of confidence? Lack of confidence? By the galaxy, Dr. Darrell, on what would you base any other attitude? Come here. He half-led, half-forced Darrell toward the limpid ovoid, cradled gracefully on its tiny force-field support. At a touch of the mayor's hand, it glowed within, an accurate three-dimensional model of the galactic double spiral. In yellow, said the mayor excitedly, we have that region of space under Foundation control. In red, that under Calgan. What Darrell saw was a crimson sphere resting within a stretching yellow fist that surrounded it on all sides but that toward the center of the galaxy. Galactography, said the mayor, is our greatest enemy. Our admirals make no secret of our almost helpless strategic position. Observe, the enemy has inner lines of communication. He is concentrated. He can meet us on all sides with equal ease. He can defend himself with minimum force. We are expanded. The average distance between inhabited systems within the Foundation is nearly three times that within Calgan. To go from Santani to Locris, for instance, is a voyage of 2,500 parsecs for us, but only 800 parsecs for them, if we remain within our respective territories. Darrell said, I understand all that, sir. And you do not understand that it may mean defeat? There is more than distance to war. I say we cannot lose. It is quite impossible. And why do you say that? Because of my own interpretation of the Selden plan. Oh. The mayor's lips twisted, and the hands behind his back flapped one within the other. Then you rely, too, on the mystical help of the Second Foundation? No, merely on the help of inevitability, and of courage and persistence. And yet behind his easy confidence, he wondered, What if Anthor were right, and Calgan were a direct tool of the mental wizards? What if it was their purpose to defeat and destroy the Foundation? No, it made no sense. And yet, he smiled bitterly, all was the same. Always that peering and peering through the opaque granite, which to the enemy was so transparent. Nor were the galactographic verities of the situation lost upon Stettin. The Lord of Calgan stood before a twin of the galactic model which the mayor and Darrell had inspected. Except that where the mayor frowned, Stettin smiled. His admiral's uniform glistered imposingly upon his massive figure. The crimson sash of the Order of the Mule, awarded him by the former first citizen, whom 6 months later he had replaced somewhat forcefully, spanned his chest diagonally from right shoulder to waist. The silver star with double comets and swords sparkled brilliantly upon his left shoulder. He addressed the 6 men of his general staff, whose uniforms were only less grandiloquent than his own, and his first minister as well, thin and gray, a darkling cobweb lost in the brightness. Stettin said, "I think the decisions are clear. We can afford to wait. To them, every day of delay will be another blow at their morale. If they attempt to defend all portions of their realm, they will be spread thin, and we can strike through in 2 simultaneous thrusts, here and here." He indicated the directions on the galactic model. 2 lances of pure white, shooting through the yellow fist from the red ball it enclosed, cutting Terminus off on either side in a tight arc. "In such a manner, we cut their fleet into 3 parts, which can be defeated in detail. If they concentrate, they give up 2/3 of their dominions voluntarily, and will probably risk rebellion." The First Minister's thin voice alone seeped through the hush that followed. "In 6 months," he said, "the Foundation will grow 6 months stronger. Their resources are greater, as we all know. Their navy is numerically stronger. Their manpower is virtually inexhaustible. Perhaps a quick thrust would be safer." He was easily the least influential voice in the room. Lord Stettin smiled and made a flat gesture with his hand. "The 6 months or a year, if necessary, will cost us nothing. The men of the Foundation cannot prepare. They are ideologically incapable of it. It is in their very philosophy to believe that the second Foundation will save them. But not this time, huh?" The men in the room stirred uneasily. "You lack confidence, I believe," said Stettin frigidly. "Is it necessary once again to describe the reports of our agents in Foundation territory, or to repeat the findings of Mr. Homer Munn, the Foundation agent now in our, service? Let us adjourn, gentlemen." Stettin returned to his private chambers with a fixed smile still on his face. He sometimes wondered about this Homer Munn, a queer water-spined fellow who certainly did not bear out his early promise. And yet he crawled with interesting information that carried conviction with it, particularly when Callia was present. His smile broadened. That fat fool had her uses after all. At least she got more with her wheedling out of Munn than he could, and with less trouble. Why not give her to Munn? He frowned. Callia. She and her stupid jealousy. Space, if he still had the Daryl girl. Why hadn't he ground her skull to powder for that? He couldn't quite put his finger on the reason. Maybe because she got along with Munn, and he needed Munn. It was Munn, for instance, who had demonstrated that, at least in the belief of the Mule, there was no second Foundation. His admirals needed that assurance. He would have liked to make the proofs public, but it was better to let the Foundation believe in their non-existent help. Was it actually Callia who had pointed that out? That's right, she had said... Oh, nonsense, she couldn't have said anything. And yet, he shook his head to clear it, and passed on. Chapter 18. Ghost of a World. Trantor was a world in dregs and rebirth, set like a faded jewel in the midst of the bewildering crowd of suns at the center of the galaxy, in the heaps and clusters of stars piled high with aimless prodigality. It alternately dreamed of past and future. Time had been when the insubstantial ribbons of control had stretched out from its metal coating to the very edges of stardom. It had been a single city, housing 400 billion administrators, the mightiest capital that had ever been, until the decay of the empire eventually reached it, and in the great sack of a century ago, its drooping powers had been bent back upon themselves, and broken forever. In the blasting ruin of death, the metal shell that circled the planet wrinkled and crumpled into an aching mock of its own grandeur. This book is continued on cassette number 7.